Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. President Donald Trump is likely to decertify the nuclear deal with Iran and turn it back to Congress for possible renewed sanctions.
We must not allow Iran to obtain nuclear weapons. The Iranian regime supports terrorism and exports violence, bloodshed, and chaos across the Middle East. That is why we must put an end to Iran's continued aggression and nuclear ambitions. They have not lived up to the spirit of their agreement.
Trump is expected to announce his plans in a speech next week. Following the president's trip to hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico, as the Caribbean continues to clean up and recover from recent hurricanes, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders says the second-in-command will also pay the islands a visit.
The vice president will be traveling to Florida, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. He will meet with survivors, local officials, and first responders and personally assess the massive recovery efforts. The federal government continues to provide much-needed personnel and supplies to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Nate is now heading toward the Gulf Coast of the U.S. Officials say days and months before carrying out the worst mass shooting in recent U.S. history, Stephen Paddock rented hotel rooms overlooking other musical festivals in Las Vegas as well as in Chicago. Reports citing law enforcement officials say Paddock reserved two rooms overlooking the Lollapalooza Festival in Chicago, which draws hundreds of thousands of fans yearly. Paddock did not check into that room. On Wall Street, stocks rose. This is VOA News. The U.S. military has confirmed three U.S. service members were killed and two others injured when a joint U.S.-Niger military patrol was attacked Wednesday in southwestern Niger. Chief Pentagon spokesperson Dana White.
Last night, three U.S. service members and one partner nation member were killed. Two U.S. service members were injured while conducting an advise and assist mission in Niger's security forces in southwest Niger. On behalf of everyone on the department and the Secretary of Defense, we extend our deepest condolences and sympathies to the families of the fallen and those injured in this attack.
The United States has about 800 service members in Niger to provide support to the U.S. Embassy and counterterrorism training for government forces battling Islamist militant groups. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the attack. British writer Kazuo Ishiguro wins the Nobel Prize for Literature, marking a return to traditional interpretations of the prize after singer-songwriter Bob Dylan won last year. Matthew LaRotonda reports.
The Nobel Prize in Literature 2017 is awarded to the English writer Kazuo Ishiguro.
British writer Kazuo Ishiguro has won the Nobel Prize for Literature, a 62-year-old author, one of the most critically acclaimed in the United Kingdom in modern times. He's written books with themes of regret, acceptance, and absurdity. Born in Japan, Ishiguro has also been vocal on world crises, including xenophobia and immigration.
I hope that these kinds of themes will actually be in some small way helpful to the climate we have at the moment, because I think we've entered a very uncertain time in the world at the moment.
One of Ishiguro's most renowned works, Remains of the Day, details the life of an elderly butler, whether it was wasted in years of obedience and his missed chance at falling in love. It was turned into a 1993 movie featuring Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson, nominated for an Oscar.
He's an exquisite novelist. I would say that if you mix Jane Austen and Kafka, you get Ishiguro in a nutshell.
Ishiguro didn't know he'd actually won the prize until he was contacted by media, initially thinking it was a hoax. He now takes his place in a pantheon of greats, including Toni Morrison and Ernest Hemingway, this year returning the prize to its more traditionally interpreted roots after it was given to Bob Dylan last year.
This is VOA.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, October 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's vice president denies he's undermining President Robert Mugabe.
My commitment to national unity, peace and stability is undoubted and unquestionable. I have an impeccable history of unflinching loyalty to the party and His Excellency the President, Commander Robert Mugabe, and have never acted in a manner that undermines his authority.
That's Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. A group of Ugandan lawyers have petitioned the Speaker of Parliament to stop debate on amending age limit in the Constitution. Opposition politicians in Zambia want an investigation into the purchase of 42 fire engines for $42 million. And Rwanda's former female presidential candidate goes to court today on charges of inciting insurrection.
My mother and my other sister are not politicians. But why do you go after my mother and my sister as well? And they had also arrested my other brothers before. What were they being accused of?
Aristide Rigara is the younger brother of Rwandan politician Diane Rigara. And Somalia is getting help from the International Monetary Fund on the cost of printing a new currency. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post in our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe's Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who lately seemed to have lost favor with President Robert Mugabe, held a news conference late Thursday to dispel speculation that he was plotting against the president. Immediately after, the country's first lady described Mnangagwa as a rough element in the ruling ZANU-PF party. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, a pro-first lady faction of the ruling party is planning to protest against the vice president today, Friday.
The 75-year-old Mnangagwa, once a clear favorite to become Zimbabwe's next leader, has fallen out of favor with President Robert Mugabe. On arrival from South Africa on Wednesday, the 93-year-old Zimbabwean leader slapped Mnangagwa's chest and refused to greet him at the airport. Sources say Mr. Mugabe was not happy with weekend claims made by Mnangagwa that he had been poisoned at a rally where Mugabe addressed recently. At the rushed Thursday briefing in Harare, Mnangagwa said his remarks on being poisoned had been taken out of context.
My commitment to national unity, peace and stability is undoubted and unquestionable. As espoused in the national constitution, I have an impeccable history of unflinching loyalty to the party and His Excellency the President, Commander Robert Mugabe, and have never acted in a manner that undermines his authority or the stability of Zimbabwe.
But First Lady Grace Mugabe has on several occasions said Mnangagwa is plotting to take over from her husband, who has ruled Zimbabwe since 1980, when the country got its independence from Britain. As if she was reacting to Mnangagwa's late Thursday media briefing, Mrs. Mugabe insisted that the vice president wanted to create an impression that Zimbabwe's first family had poisoned him in August this year.
That is unfair to say that. Ndinganoite prepare a copy imwe chete for Mnangagwa, kurai Mnangagwa kuti ndaita sei. I'm the wife of the president who is Mnangagwa on this earth. Ndiani angatorai mumwe papa kuti ndinodei kwari hapana tandomboda kwari tari tisinei. Aiwa, munhu akatopiwa basa nemurume wangu ndomurayi. It's nonsensical.
Why would I prepare a cup of tea to kill Mnangagwa? She asked. I am the wife of the president. Who is Mnangagwa on this earth? Between him and me, who can actually kill the other? What would I want from him that I do not have? I kill a person who was actually given a job by my husband? She asked. That's nonsensical. In all this, Mr. Mugabe has not said much about Mnangagwa, arguably the longest surviving ally of the Zimbabwean leader. They met during Zimbabwe's Liberation War about 50 years ago, but now it seems their marriage is now on the rocks, as the adage goes. This Friday, a pro-Mrs. Mugabe faction is set to march in Zimbabwe's capital against Mnangagwa, whom they accuse of plotting to undermine Mr. Mugabe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A group of Ugandan lawyers have petitioned the Speaker of Parliament, Rebecca Kadaga, to stop debate on amending age limit in the Constitution. Robert Kagoro, the lead counsel for lawyers opposed to the amendment of the controversial bill, says debating the age limit bill is illegal. Mugume Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala.
Kampala-based constitution lawyer Kagoro says the parliament cannot go on with age limit debate while the matter is still pending in the courts.
We are saying, wait a minute, wait for the courts to determine these issues. It is against the rules of parliamentary procedure, specifically Rule 64, which prohibits the Parliament of the Republic of Uganda to discuss issues that are pending in court. That's what we call sub judice. It is sub judice. You cannot discuss matters of court. In other words, you are trying to determine the issues in court when you are not a court of law.
Lawyers wrote to Speaker Kadaga on Tuesday asking her to immediately stop the age limit debate until the court disposes of Alipanga case. In 2014, through his lawyers, Ugandan citizen Benjamin Alipanga petitioned the Constitution Court asking for a permanent injunction against Parliament from amending or in any way tampering with various provisions of the Constitution, including the controversial Article 102B. This article requires a person contesting for the presidency of Uganda to be between 35 to 75 years of age. Justice Minister Mwesigwa Rukutana is the Deputy Attorney General and represents the government.
No court can give an order to Parliament by whatever means, whether it is temporary or final, prohibiting it from carrying out its mandate of making laws for the good governance of the country. Amending the Constitution is one of the ways Parliament does its duties to fulfill its mandate of making laws for the good governance.
Kagoro says Rukutana is simply talking as a politician. He says Ugandans, through courts of law, have powers to challenge political decisions and policies.
Courts can remove the president, that is the head of the executive. The court can remove the speaker from parliament. The court can remove the members of parliament. More importantly, the parliament, through the attorney general, filed a reply to our petition. In other words, the parliament has brought itself to the jurisdiction of courts, so it must respect the courts.
Uganda's constitution grants every Ugandan citizen the civic right to participate in the affairs of government. The controversial bill was this week read for the first time and referred to the Legal and the Parliamentary Affairs Committee for further scrutiny. Parliamentarians are also expected to traverse the country seeking views from ordinary citizens. Those opposed to the amendment say the bill favors the current president, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, to contest the 2021 elections. Mr. Museveni, who is 73, has been in power for more than 3 decades. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 6th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Former Rwandan presidential candidate Diane Rwigara and her mother and sister are due in court today, Friday, to answer charges of inciting insurrection and forgery. The court will determine whether the charges justify their continuing detention. Ms. Rwigara, who wanted to be Rwanda's first female president, was disqualified by the Election Commission from competing in the August election because the commission said she failed to garner the required 600 signatures needed to put her name on the ballot. She, her mother, and sister were arrested August 30th. Arrestee Rwigara, younger brother of Ms. Rwigara, says the charges against his sister and mother are bogus. He says Rwandan government is retaliating against Ms. Rwigara because she wanted to challenge President Paul Kagame.
My reaction is that the charges are laughable because they're totally made up.
And proof of that, among many, is that they keep switching charges. Every day they make up something new. First they were saying that she, along with the other family members, were being charged of tax evasion. Now the tax evasion charges are gone because it was all made up. And now they're saying that she's being charged of inciting the people to insurrection. This is being swept from conspiracy against the state, by the way. That charge has been dropped. I mean, you see major charges like that getting dropped because it's BS. And this new charge of inciting the insurrection among people is absurd as well. It's totally made up. And the forgery charges are made up. This is persecution. This is retaliation against her because she ran for president. That's all that it is. All these charges are baseless. This upcoming trial is going to be a travesty.
Why do you say that this is retaliation? Because the government said that she was not qualified. She did not meet the requirement to participate in the election.
She more than met the requirements. She had almost double the number of required signatures. And she was extremely popular in Rwanda. She was so popular that they had to cheat in order to win. They made up stories about forgery because they were scared of her. She would have won had she been allowed to run. So they had to kill her campaign by making up allegations of forgery. I mean, first they say that she used the names of people who were dead. And now they're saying that she used the names of people who never existed. You see how they keep changing allegations? Because it's all made up.
Is it true that Rigara's mother and her sister are also being detained with her?
Yes, I mean, this really shows the ridiculousness of all of this. I mean, my mother and my other sister are not politicians. But why do you go after my mother and my sister as well? And they had also arrested my other brothers before. What were they being accused of?
What about the allegations of tax evasion against the family? That your family owned a tobacco company and that the company probably evaded taxes?
That is absolutely not true. My family never evaded taxes. Those allegations were produced right when my sister was running for president. It was a retaliatory tactic to repress her, to punish her for running for president.
The court is to consider Friday what they call the serious grounds justifying provisional detention of your sister and your mother. Do you expect that probably they will be released?
Well, I definitely do not expect them to release them on humanitarian kind of grounds out of compassion for two women, especially my mother, who's not young anymore and who's been under extreme duress for a long time now. My mother is very sick right now. I hope in my whole heart that they will be released, but I cannot put any sort of faith in the government. So, unfortunately, I'm scared that they might remain detained.
Aristide, thank you very much. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Aristide Rwigara is the younger brother of jailed former Rwandan female presidential candidate Diane Rwigara. He was speaking with me from Los Angeles, California. Opposition members of parliament in Zambia have petitioned the Speaker of Parliament to launch an investigation into the recent purchase of 42 fire engines at a cost of $42 million. Critics say the government appears to have misplaced priorities by paying $1 million for each of the fire engines instead of investing the money to help alleviate poverty in the country. But local government minister Vincent Mwale defended the government, saying no cabinet minister had a hand in the procurement of the fire engines. Kapelwa Mbengweta, a Zambian parliamentarian from the opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, tells viewers Peter Clotty he supports the call for an investigation into this scandal.
There are two issues which are basically a challenge from sections of the society. One is the cost, and two, the priority at the moment in relation to other pressing needs for the country. And three, the fire tenders which have been bought do not cover all the district councils, if you like.
I heard there has been a petition for a thorough investigation to begin from Parliament. What do you know about this?
I was told that there's been a request which might be underway to request for a special selective committee to look into the issue.
As a member of Parliament, what are you hearing from your constituent regarding this fire tender issue?
The constituents are happy about the fire tender issue. First of all, it's a cost per unit at $1 million, that's an issue. And also the fact that in terms of our priorities as a country, the cost related to this purchase might not necessarily reflect the priorities, especially from the rural point of view, which I represent myself.
Some officials of the government are saying that fire experts were sent to Spain, and based on their specifications, the fire tenders were manufactured for the Zambia market, and that all these noise being made are just noise for the sake of politics. What do you say to that?
Well, that's not necessarily correct, because first of all, we have not physically seen the specifications in terms of what he explained. So, for example, the specifications in our situation, I would like to imagine that is this relates to the size of the road where these fire tenders would go. It also might relate to the fire hydrants where they might have to get water from. Now, we don't have a lot of fire hydrants in most of our towns and so on. And so it will be very difficult to agree to say these specifications with what was used, because that's where the issue is. And also, even in terms of the areas where these fire tenders are supposed to be sent to, might not necessarily have similar facilities. For example, even the roads themselves, the weeds, the accessibility of certain areas. So there are a lot of variations. So that's what the problem is. Yes, I'm trying to explain that, but the unit cost is an issue.
Why is the unit cost an issue, since these were specifically for the Zambia market?
What I would say to that is that, you see, first of all, I've talked about the priority in relation to the cost. As a country, we have a lot of challenges in terms of literacy levels, water and sanitation and so on. So when you say a priority in relation to the fire tenders, that's a first problem which is there. The second is that the cost itself and the sophistication, if the cost is related, for example, to doing the sophistication of a particular item, then you'd be saying in Zambia we don't have, for example, tall buildings which might require maybe that sort of level of sophistication.
Kapelwa Umbegweta is a Zambian member of parliament from the opposition United Party for National Development. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital Lusaka. Somalia's finance minister says the International Monetary Fund has taken the lead in covering the cost to print the country's new currency. Abdirahman Duale Bele says the IMF has agreed to give a grant to the Somali government to print the new currency before the end of the year.
We are working with the IMF, and we have agreed on a number of things on our side. We needed to strengthen the governance issues, the accountability issues, the skills available in the central bank, the rules and regulations, the monetary systems, the policies. All those things have been a prerequisite for us printing money, new money, Somali money. We have concluded all those. We are now discussing the timing, and more importantly, we are discussing the sources of the cost of the money, printing the money. But our agreement has always been that towards the end of the year, we have to be able to print money, local money.
How much money are you printing?
I'm not privy to that yet, but it will be adequate for the economy of Somalia.
How are you financing this effort, this work to print a new currency?
As you know, Somalia is a very poor country, and we have a lot of debt. Under normal circumstances, countries either borrow money to print their money, or better yet, they finance from their own resources. Given the situation we are in, somebody else has to help us get that money. And we are working very closely with the IMF and the international community to grant us the amount of money necessary to print adequate quantity of money.
How much do you need to print this new currency? And did you get firm confirmation, firm acceptance from IMF that they will provide you this money?
The cost of printing adequate money is 50 million. I think there is also about the same amount of the same quantity will be necessary to deposit and keep it as a reserve to monitor the movements of supply and demand kind of thing. So the money does not lose value very quickly to keep the value, so to speak. So all those funds are being discussed. The IMF is taking the lead in assisting us securing those funds.
So over the past 20 years or so, there has been all the Somali currency banknotes as well as newly printed counterfeit money that's circulating in the market. How are you going to deal with those?
Well, the issue here is Somalia is, as you know, in a very unique situation. I don't think there is any country that has ever come as low as we are in terms of economy and in terms of managing our own currency. That being the case, we have to decide what we should accept to exchange.
Abdirahman Dualebele is Somalia's finance minister. He spoke with reporter Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the World Football Governing Body FIFA's ban on Equatorial Guinea, who will no longer be participating in the 2019 Women's World Cup in France for fielding 10 ineligible players and using forged documents. The players all took part in qualifying for the 2016 Olympic Women's Tournament in Brazil. FIFA has also imposed a fine of $102,000 on the country's football association. The two-time champions will not future at the 2020 Olympics and the next two Women's Africa Cup of Nations in 2018 and 2020. Now to the 2018 Russia World Cup qualifying matches, where five places have been reserved for Africa, and Nigeria, Tunisia and Egypt co-fill three of them this weekend. Nigeria will secure its sixth appearance at the Global Football Showpiece by winning in Uyo against Zambia, the only other Group B contenders. Germany-born Nigerian coach Gerard Rohr says the players are focused on getting a win, which will seal a spot for the side in Russia.
What I'm looking for was to score the goals, to win the duels, to go on the sides, on the wings. We like to play like that. And to win, even in the training game, we want to win. So I saw that everybody wanted to win the training game. And so I'm satisfied by the work they could do today.
For his sport, Zambia head coach Wetsin Yirinda is confident of beating the Super Eagles, even though he predicts a very difficult game.
Not going to be an easy game, but I think with the plans that we have put in place, the output from the players, I think we are looking so much ready.
Elsewhere, Ghana will be without five first-team regulars for the weekend match, including defender Harrison Afful and captain Asamoah Gyan, who led the team in its 5-1 demolition of Congo Brazzaville in their last World Cup qualifier. But head coach James Kwesi Appiah is optimistic the team will rally to beat Uganda and keep alive their hopes of reaching the 2018 World Cup in Russia.
Playing in Kampala, it's not going to be an easy game. But saying that, as you can see, there are so many new players in the team, and they have a task ahead of them, you know, to prove that they deserve to be in the team. I'm building a new team, and anyone who wears the jersey needs to not prove to me, to prove to all Ghanaians.
Uganda head coach Moses Basena, while reacting to the possibility of qualifying for the World Cup at the expense of Ghana, says no team will want to lose.
Nobody wants to lose, but I would call it a wake-up call to everybody in the team that we have the big one on Saturday.
And for the Pharaohs of Egypt, they can end 28 years in the World Cup wilderness with a home victory over Congo Brazzaville this weekend if Uganda fails to collect the maximum points against visiting Ghana. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, October 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson Omale, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa will have a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Peter Clarty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.